The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Morning glory, America, and happy new year. I am Hugh Hewitt, so glad to have you with me as the dawn of the new year breaks out over America. Thank you for being your new year with us. I hope you had a wonderful New Year's Day and a terrific football and that everything is good in your life. Your New Year's resolution should include going immediately to HughHewitt.com and ordering my brand new book, The Fourth Way. The Fourth Way is everything the Republicans have got to do, the playbook for the next 6 months that will lead into victories 2 years from now, how to turn this country around, how to turn the economy around. That's your number one New Year's resolution. Go and do it right now. The Fourth Way by Hugh Hewitt. It's over at HughHewitt.com. And a special broadcast for you today, a Hillsdale dialogue that stretches out over 3 hours, the rest of our march through history, which we begin on the last broadcast day of the year, with Dr. Larry Arnn, president of Hillsdale College. All things Hillsdale available at HughForHillsdale.com. HughForHillsdale.com. But, of course, Dr. Arnn will be new to some of you because I get to pick up new stations at the beginning of the year. That's perhaps where we should begin with exactly who it is we are talking with and what college we are talking about before we launch into the ideas.
So let's start with Hillsdale. Describe for those who are just tuning in for the first time in this epic broadcast what Hillsdale is and its mission.
Hillsdale is a liberal arts college located in southern Michigan. It's old. It was founded before the Civil War. And its distinction early was that it was one of the forces, one of the few important forces that helped to found the Republican Party and bring Abraham Lincoln to power. And it had more of its sons go and fight for the Union Army in the Civil War than any college except West Point, where they all had to go. Nearly all of our boys went. And we were small and young then. The distinction today is we try to stick as close as we can to that original idea of the liberal arts college that really is refined and, in my opinion, perfected by the American Revolution. If you're going to have a society where people govern themselves, you need liberally educated people, people who've thought about the highest things and understand them, in order to equip them for rule, for leadership, for citizenship. And we stick very close to that. We refuse, an amazing thing to do, every penny that the federal government offers us, and because of that, we don't have to put up with any of the commands that they give, which are many and numerous and often vile. And so it's a singular kind of place.
How many students are enrolled there?
We have 1,150 students. It's a small liberal arts college. We believe that you can't do the job on a big scale. If you come to Hillsdale, you'll spend your first year and a half studying the same thing that every student studies here. It begins with two readers, one called Western Heritage and one called American Heritage, where we go through most of the works that we're talking about here on this program. And you study the great books, you study the tradition of rhetoric, you study the sciences, and you'll do that in classes that have 12 or 14 or 15 people in them.
Wow. So who are your faculty?
I'm sorry?
Who are your faculty?
Well, we have 110 people. We have a ratio of 11 to 1 between students and faculty. That's very good. And these people are splendid teachers and scholars who, as a body, are closely united around the original mission of the college. I'll name a couple. Probably our most popular teacher is the dean of the social sciences division. His name is Tom Connor, and he teaches a course on the First and Second World Wars every year that they're hanging from the rafters. And it's hard to get into the course. And in the summer, he often takes kids to go visit the battlefields. We have a professor in Christian studies who teaches C.S. Lewis. His name is Michael Bauman. It's the devil to get into that course. I don't know if I could get into that course, although I want to go sometime. We just hired a young man named Andrew Cuneo in English, who also wrote his doctoral thesis on C.S. Lewis. Over in the sciences, we have some biologists and chemists and physicists that are just fabulous, and the kids flock to them and have dinner at their house and hang out all the time.
Are you shuttling along there at too many applications and not enough seats?
Well, we're very selective, and we're becoming increasingly more so. We're looking for students who have good characters and good minds, and a Hillsdale education is a specific kind of thing.
Now, Hillsdale also puts out, and I'm going to either mispronounce it twice or pronounce it correctly on the first go, Imprimis. Am I pronouncing that correctly?
Everybody who works for Hillsdale College says Imprimis, which means in the first place. But if you don't say Imprimis and you say Imprimis, that's fine, too.
Well, Imprimis, then, although I do not work for Hillsdale College, is a monthly letter or a newsletter. What would you call Imprimis? I've been getting it for years.
It's a speech digest. What we have three national conferences around about the country every year, and we get famous people to come. And we have four series of seminars each year on the campus, plus we have convocations and commencements. And because of those various events, some of the most famous people in the world come and talk for Hillsdale College. So we've had Ronald Reagan in Imprimis and Justice Thomas recently and Margaret Thatcher recently. And it's a lot of people like that. Tony Snow is in the current issue.
I think Mark Helprin did an Imprimis at the end of last year, which was really quite breathtaking. Am I correct in remembering that?
Mark spoke at we have an annual dinner in honor of Winston Churchill every year in Washington, D.C., around the time of Churchill's birthday, which is November 30th. This year the speaker was Jesse Helms. He'll be in the next Imprimis. And last year the speaker was Mark Helprin, and Mark Helprin, who, as you know, is a novelist, an award-winning novelist. He also writes powerful articles for the press, especially
and he's
for
a soldier.
The Wall Street Journal. And he's a genius, and he's a good friend of mine. And
oh,
he's
I didn't
a very
know that.
Powerful writer.
Yeah. And so anyone who is listening can order Imprimis, can't they? And they get it for free.
It's free.
1.5 million copies you send out. That's quite a postage bill.
1,200,000 a month.
Oh, well, we'll get it up there then.
And we at Hillsdale, not only do we refuse the federal taxpayer dollar, but it's also true that we are long for the day when the post office can be privatized and there can be real competition, so our postage bill will go down.
Imprimis can be ordered, you can be added to their list by dialing 1-800-437-2268. That's 1-800-437-2268. And I want to emphasize, there's absolutely no cost, no obligation. They just like to disseminate ideas. Am I correct, Dr. Arne?
And we never give our mailing list to anybody else. So you won't get a pile of mail because you sign up for Imprimis.
You'll just get good ideas. Well, let's turn to good ideas. When last we left off, we were talking about Augustine, the great saint of the late decline of the Roman Empire. And we're going to flash forward a little bit to his successor as doctor of theology in the church, Aquinas. Tell us a little bit about Thomas.
Well, Thomas Aquinas is an Italian. He went to seminary. He met the great thinker, theologian Albert Magnus. He was a big, heavyset, taciturn man in speech, and so they gave him in seminary the appellation Dumb Ox. G.K. Chesterton has written a fabulous essay about Thomas Aquinas called Aquinas the Dumb Ox. Aquinas was a prolific author. He wrote huge books, the most famous being the Summa Theologica, my favorite being the Summa Contra Gentiles, that means the summation of the case against the heretics or the non-believers. The word Gentiles looks like Gentiles. But there's also a book he wrote, that book is, and the Summa Theological have both been excerpted from in some small volumes, my favorite of those being Treatise on the Law, which is taken mostly from entirely from the Summa Theologica, and it's about the different kinds of law, including the natural law. And then the last thing I'd mention is Thomas wrote, he began at the end of his life, a summation of the Summa Theologica. The Summa Theologica is a difficult work because it's written in the form of the disputed question.
Boy, is that an understatement.
It's wonderful. Now, the Summa Contra Gentiles, which I like better, partly for this reason, is written in a treatise form. It's just he makes arguments about things. He makes arguments about everything. But he tried to summarize the Summa Theologica in a book called The Light of Faith, which is itself a fairly weighty book, but it's just one volume. And it is simpler, and it's arranged according to the order of faith, hope, and charity. three Christian virtues. And that's a wonderful book to read. And
why do we care, with a minute to our break, why do we care about Aquinas anymore, this difficult bookmaker?
The classical world contained a lot of wisdom and not Jesus Christ. And so after Jesus Christ, something had to be done about that wisdom. It had to come to be understood anew in light of the revelation of Jesus Christ. Thomas Aquinas, especially in regard to the philosopher Aristotle, is the most important man in that enterprise. More important, I believe, than Augustine, and different from Augustine. And if you want to examine the question of what the virtue, the status of the virtues, the status of man is, according to human reason, after the revelation of Jesus, everyone should read Thomas Aquinas.
On that note, we take our first break on this part four of the special edition of the Hugh Hewitt Show on New Year's Eve and New Year's Day. We are walking through the great thinkers of Western civilization with Dr. Larry Arnn, president of Hillsdale College. When we return to the Italian Machiavelli. Don't go anywhere. This is the Hugh Hewitt Show. Welcome back, America. It's Hugh Hewitt on the special edition of the Hugh Hewitt Show. Thank you for listening. Originally taped for airing on December 31st and January 1st of the new year, 2001-2002. We are joined by Dr. Larry Arnn, president of Hillsdale College, as we walk through sort of the cliff notes, even a bare-bones cliff notes of that, of the great thinkers of Western civilization, so that you can accomplish your New Year's resolution early this year by at least learning a little bit more than you knew last year. Machiavelli, I sat through weeks and weeks of lectures on Machiavelli by a fellow named Harvey Mansfield, a professor of political theory at Harvard. And he always spoke of Machiavelli reverentially. He wrote a great deal about him as well as of the break. And there I was banging my little sophomore head against the table. What is this break? What is this break? So why is Machiavelli referred to in the same breath as the break, Dr. Arnn?
Well, you studied with the best man on that subject that there is. He's a friend of mine, as of yours, and a great man. What it means is that Machiavelli decided to attempt to change the focus of philosophy. He criticized the ancients for their attempt to construct imaginary republics, for their attempt to understand how men ought to be. What he wanted to do instead was dwell upon how they are. He wished to give up the question of the good and concentrate more on the question of the useful. This break, this change, has had profound implications for thought and for the world we live in, every respect of our lives. The first and most famous thing about Machiavelli is that there is an adjective that made out of his name that refers to a kind of politics, Machiavellian. And I'll give you an example of why that phrase represents justly something that is in Machiavelli. In Book 7, Chapter 7 of Machiavelli's most famous work, it's short, it's easy to read, it's very powerful, called The Prince, Machiavelli tells a story that is the classic story of Machiavellianism. There, Duke Valentino has conquered Romagna, and there are a host of petty tyrants there, and he has to submit them to his rule. And so he sends a man named Ramiro d'Orco there, a man of exceptional cruelty, who works a terror upon the population and reduces it to subservience to Valentino. But then after the cruelties have all been worked and the subservience is established, Valentino then goes, puts Ramiro d'Orco to death by quartering him and puts his severed body on display in the public square, winning thereby the affection of the people upon whom he had previously worked a terror. Now, there's a lot of things like that in Machiavelli.
Yeah,
he's a very amusing reading, especially to the young man.
Yes.
But you have to see that what's going on in classical philosophy is an attempt to find a standard of right to which we could conform that would be eternal and outside us. Classical philosophy looks up. Machiavelli looks at us. He's interested in making us better. But he derives the idea of what constitutes better by a study of the conditions around us now, understanding both the evil and the potential for good in men. This question of the good is called into question, both by things that Machiavelli says, like what I just told you, but also by his whole approach. And that's what constitutes the break. Let us look at this world. Let us give up on worlds that do not exist.
Well, then I have to ask, well, we will sometime today get to a fellow by the name of Madison, who wrote, if men were angels, no government would be necessary. Does that make Madison a Machiavelli?
Certainly not. Madison's quote, the burden of that quote, which is one of the most beautiful quotes in the Federalist Papers, if, you know, what is government but the profoundest of all reflections on human nature? If men were angels, no government would be necessary. If angels were to govern men, neither internal nor external controls on the government would be needed. Madison's quote is a quote oriented by the distinction between the man and the angel, just as the Declaration of Independence is oriented by the distinction between God and man. And so, it is not only the demands and the pressures of this world that give rise to his thinking. It's also with an eye to the higher world that he defines his politics.
Stay right there, America. I'll be right back. We'll talk more about Madison as we walk through history with Dr. Larry Aaron of Hillsdale College. All the Hillsdale Dialogues available at q4hillsdale.com. Everything Hillsdale at hillsdale.edu. Stay with us on this first broadcast day of the new year. You're listening to the Hugh Hewitt Show. Welcome back, America. It's Hugh Hewitt, first broadcast day of the year. Remember, your New Year's resolution should be to go to HughHewitt.com, order The Fourth Way, my brand new book that will guide the Republican Revolution. They also need to be reading Machiavelli. That's why I'm talking about Machiavelli with Dr. Larry Aaron, president of Hillsdale College. All things Hillsdale available at Hillsdale.edu. Every one of these dialogues for 4 years, all collected. Binge listen at Hugh4Hillsdale.com. Back to Machiavelli.
And Machiavelli had no eye cast up at all?
Well, no, that wouldn't be true to say. And Harvey Mansfield would shudder, I fear, at my entire performance in this thing. I want to repeat here my humility that it is my position, learned from my teacher, Harry Jaffa, that no man can really learn well more than 3 great books, and even that's very difficult. So I protest that most of what I'm talking about I don't really know. But I say that for such as Harvey Mansfield in particular. But no, Machiavelli is a contemporary of Martin Luther. And Machiavelli sees some problems that have developed in part because of the birth of Jesus and the spread of Christianity. All of a sudden, the idea grows that because there is one God for every man, then the authority to rule, to govern, comes from God. And there were abuses in church governance, which spread beyond merely spiritual matters, that were very, very difficult to correct. It's taken a long time to correct them. In my opinion, the United States of America and its doctrines are the correction of them.
I have to go back to part one of our conversation when you were talking about your teacher, Harry Jaffa. He said that he had read 3 great books, and one was The Ethics, and the other was the Bible, and the third he left unnamed. Could that third have been The Prince?
No, I think the question is more, I think Plato's Republic is included.
Oh, you're right, it wasn't.
And then the Bible or Shakespeare or... I guess it's really a contest between those two. Of course, I've speculated on this for years.
Yes, you have, but it's not The Prince.
He said, no, not for him it wouldn't be. It could be for Harvey. I don't know. I'd have to ask Harvey that. He would give me a cryptic answer just like Harry Jaffa would.
What about The Republic, Machiavelli's other great work?
Well, it's a different kind of thing than Plato's Republic. The distinction between it and, you know, all of Machiavelli's works, The Prince and The Discourses included, The Discourses on Livy, Machiavelli's idea about how to study politics is not to construct a regime of perfection and then measure the ones we have by it. It is emphatically to eschew that idea. And so these books seem very different, and all of his books seem very different than reading Plato, and especially Plato, and any of the classics.
Dr. Aaron, Martin Luther, big subject for 5 minutes. Tee it up.
Well, Luther is born in 1483 in Germany. He becomes a monk. He goes to Rome. He notices that Rome is a very worldly place. And by worldly, I mean sort of the way Washington, D.C. is today at its worst, involved in power. And
full
wealth.
Of whisperings.
Yeah, that's right. He is appalled by what he sees. The famous thing is the selling of indulgences. That is to say, there's an argument that's very important in the Reformation about the nature of church authority. That's one of a few arguments. Let me see if I can name them that's going on there. There's the nature of church authority. There's the relationship between faith and works as a means of salvation. That calls into question the standing of the virtues and the vices. The doctrines at the time that Luther came are really derived from the passage in Matthew, which says, who do you say that I am? And Peter replies, thou art the Christ, the Son of the living God. And Jesus replies to him, roughly, I don't have it in front of me, but upon the art Peter, Peter is Petra, is the Greek word for stone, and upon this rock I will build my church. And what you bind on earth, I will bind in heaven. And what you loose on earth, I will loose in heaven. And the special place of the apostles in carrying on Jesus' teaching, and this particular thing, gives rise to the idea that it is bishops, that is to say, the descendants of the apostles who have had their hands laid upon them, who carry with in a special way the message of Jesus down through the ages, and that the successors of Peter, who became the bishop of Rome, are the key representatives of God on earth. That's the Catholic, Roman Catholic doctrine. Now, what that means, though, is that you have power. And one of the things that grew up that was a terrible corruption was this idea that if you pay money to a priest, maybe to the church and maybe to the priest personally, your sins will be forgiven. In other words, do him a favor. And that corruption, by the way, is skewed by the Reformed Catholic Church that we have today. I myself understand the Pope, the current Pope, John Paul II, to be a very great man. And these arguments are very serious arguments. Well, Luther saw all that, and he rebelled against it. And that led him, in a long series of works, I think his translated works into English take up 56 volumes, that led him to develop a new way of understanding church authority, and the relationship between faith and works. These two things are related, by the way, because if the church has authority, and if works, that is to say, things that you do, are important to your salvation, that gives the church some authority to control your behavior.
He was also, though, not just a revolutionary, but he was really quite a reactionary when it came to government on this planet over people like the peasant revolt in his regions of Germany.
That's right. And what would be fair to say, you know, Luther was a conservative, you know, it's not a very good word, conservative. I'm one, but, I can say what I mean when I say that I'm a patriot. What I mean when I'm a conservative is that I want to keep certain doctrines alive, and I can name what they are. Luther was of a conservative temper. He did not wish to upset the German society. He was not, nor was Calvin, his blood brother and near contemporary. Neither of them would characterize themselves as political thinkers, as having an idea about how to govern. They thought, in general, taking passages from the Bible, that just about anybody in power, if he was in power, was put there by God, and that even the worst tyrant could not extinguish faith or attack faith. And so his politics are they're not worked out the way some Christian thinkers' politics have been. My own opinion is that that is a failing of a kind. And I'll get to that when we get to the American Revolution.
You did not mention Francis Bacon, and I don't know anything about Francis Bacon. Why did you pick him? What do we need to know?
I picked him because of one word, science. Bacon is a development on Machiavelli that leads to the understanding of science in the sense of modern science, technology. Bacon's chief works are the New Atlantis and the New Organum, Novum Organum. He also wrote a utopian work. Bacon agrees with Machiavelli that we have to concentrate on the here and the now. But he adds something, and that is, what do people want in the here and the now? Who do they admire? What do they love? Are they grateful for their heroes, or are they grateful for the people who help them? the expression, the relief of man's estate, is born in Bacon. And Bacon foresees a time in which there will be enormous energy poured into that, and that we will have science bended to the job, not of discovering the greatest and deepest and most fundamental truth, but of being serviceable.
He was born in 1561. He dies in 1626, so this makes him an Elizabethan.
That's right.
Okay.
That's right. And the Renaissance is going on. And it's a, you know, there's a ferment underway. You know, because what in if you look at if you go back and you look at the doctrines of Plato's Republic, for example, what they're doing is something that issues in the end in a series of questions. And the account of the good life that is implicit, it's not explicit, but implicit in Plato's works is a good life is a life of argument about the highest things. Where that argument ends, you don't get a doctrinaire statement. You get more of that in Aristotle, but not in Plato. Well, this is the opposite idea. This is serviceability. This is usefulness. And it is very powerful in Bacon. And Bacon makes, of course, a very, very powerful point.
So, but I'm not getting this. You think Bacon is important because he stresses that we ought to put science in the harness and make it make the lights down at night.
He's one of the way stations along the way of modern philosophy. And remember, Machiavelli turns from elevation to usefulness in his politics. But here is the introduction of a tool of usefulness that has become, of course, one of the defining things in our lives. Why, you ask yourself, do we care about the Taliban? 100 years ago, we would not have known their names, but it is because of science that they can strike us, and we can strike them back. The world is remade by a spirit, an energy, a method, an enterprise that is really articulated first and clearly in the works of Bacon.
And it is a very spare... Just the facts, ma'am. The launch of the scientific method.
Yeah, you could say that. But remember, that implies something, remember. That implies what is the high, you know, because philosophy, that means the love of wisdom. And wisdom, Aristotle says, is knowledge of the things that do not change. And so each of these people that we're talking about are giving an account of the highest things. They're giving a great account of those things. And so implicit in this turn to the usefulness of modern science is this idea that that is indeed the highest thing, usefulness. Usefulness to what? Usefulness to our love of honor, our sense of justice? No. Usefulness to our comfort, our preservation, our prosperity. Remember what Spock in Star Trek always says. What's his greeting and his farewell? Live long and prosper. So length and wealth are the things about life. But of course they're not. It's in it, you know, why are we all going around wearing caps and T-shirts that say FDNY? The people,
you're right.
those firemen who went up in that building did not live long, and they are not prosperous today, except in honor and service to right. There is a narrowing of the perspective that goes on here.
Honor and service to right. That is what we are about on this, the first broadcast day of the year. Hugh for Hillsdale.com. If you're just tuning in, you say, man, I wish I had all this conversation. It's over there. Hugh for Hillsdale.com. All things Hillsdale at Hillsdale.edu. Stick around. I'll be right back with Dr. Larry Arnn on the Hugh Hewitt Show. Welcome back, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt. First broadcast day of the brand new year. It's my tradition to spend it with Dr. Larry Arnn, president of Hillsdale College, if you're just tuning in. 4 hours have already gone by on the last broadcast day of the year and this first hour, but you are here in time. We are crescendoing. We are getting close. Don't forget your New Year's resolution. Head over to HughHewitt.com. Order my brand new book, The Fourth Way, indispensable. Most important book I've ever written. The guide to what we've got to do in this year with this new president, with this new Congress, and how to make it all work and to do so in an
honorable fashion. That's why we're spending so much time with Dr. Arnn today, talking about honor, talking about what you need to do to maintain your honor. All these conversations, by the way, collected at hughforhillsdale.com. Everything Hillsdale, including great courses on the Constitution, are all collected at hillsdale.edu, and you can sign up there for Imprimis, the speech digest. Let's get back to our conversation about honor with Dr. Larry Arnn, president of that august institution, the Lantern of the North, Hillsdale College.
But now Bacon is part of the court which feasted on honor. Elizabeth addressed to her sailors on the eve of the Armada, and it was all about honor. So is he apart from this whole Renaissance England thing?
I think so, and a part in it too. I don't want anybody to get the sense that I'm in rebellion against the modern world, because I'm not. I just think that there are some strains in it that are very evil and dangerous and ultimately could mean the destruction of us all. And I think that it's an important thing. I also am not talking now in order to condemn Francis Bacon. I'm not. If you wish to understand the spirit that is behind modern technology, this is an excellent place to go and look.
Then I want to switch over then to someone who we talk about regularly on this program with a professor from the United States Naval Academy, David Allen White, who's really quite a genius at talking about Shakespeare. And so we know on this program why Shakespeare is here, but let's get launched on him. He's a contemporary of Bacon's, but he's kind of the opposite.
Well, Shakespeare is... there's a speech in the Symposium, one of Plato's dialogues, where they say that there'll be a poet who will have the genius both of comedy and of tragedy in him, and that this poet will be the greatest of the poets. Well, Shakespeare wrote three kinds of plays, comedy and tragedy, and a kind he invented, history plays. And these plays, and the sonnets too, but especially the plays, if you ask the learned world or the ordinary world, who is the greatest of the writers, there would be a consensus that it's Shakespeare.
Dr. Arnn, we're talking about Shakespeare as we conclude part four. Do you make the students at Hillsdale, are they obliged to take a course in Shakespeare?
Everybody has to read Shakespeare in our freshman core course on, it's a two-semester course taught by the English department. And so everybody reads a lot of Shakespeare. And
what do they begin with?
You know, I don't really know the answer to that.
What would you have them begin with?
Well, I'll tell you what my favorites are. I love the history plays. I'm a historian. I love The Tempest. I love Macbeth. Abraham Lincoln loved Macbeth. I'll mention a thing. You know, Winston Churchill knew Macbeth off by heart, and several of them as well. I was taking a course on Macbeth with Harry Jaffa. And
would be a course.
We did Macbeth and King Lear. He's written about King Lear. By the way, King Lear, let me get it right, The Merchant of Venice and The Tempest are the three plays in which someone is described as a philosopher. That's an interesting study for somebody to undertake sometime. I remember we're reading Macbeth's description of his assassination of the King Duncan, and he began, and we're listening to somebody reading the play. It's a production of the play, and listening to them. Harry Jaffa is a big believer in that, and I commend that to anybody, to buy a recording of an excellent production of Shakespeare, not the pictures, just the words, and listen. It's fabulous, and follow along in the book. He describes the angels above crying out to him to stop, and the ghouls and devils below screaming for blood. And, of course, you know, later comes this wonderful encapsulation of the whole meaning of justice in this even-handed justice commends the poison chalice to our own lips. Well, when we got to the part where the ghouls and they were all screaming from below, Harry Jaffa picked up the needle on the phonograph he was using. And all he said was, I remember it like it's yesterday, he said, "Does this man believe that there is a moral order or not?" And they put it back down, and on we went. And, you know, of course, that is the human condition, because we all believe in a moral order and cannot escape the belief of it. And we all have our failings.
When we come back in part five of this special edition of the Hugh Hewitt Show, we're going to talk, at least begin, with an English philosopher who thought quite clearly there was a moral order. A little bit afraid of it, I think, when we come back to Thomas Hobbes. Don't go anywhere. You're listening to a special edition of this program with Dr. Larry Arnn, president of Hillsdale College, and me, your host, Hugh Hewitt, on this, the New Year's edition of the Hugh Hewitt Show.
Morning Glory, America. First brand new day of the new year with broadcast a part of it. Didn't broadcast yesterday, but this is the first broadcast day of the new year, and you are with me, second hour. Thank you for doing that. It's our tradition to begin the first broadcast day of every year with Dr. Larry Arnn of Hillsdale College, marching through the ideas that animate every discussion. It's also my intent to get you over to Amazon.com to order my new book, The Fourth Way, a conservative playbook to a lasting Republican majority. It's linked at HughHewitt.com. Vital that you get this. Most important book that I've ever read. Set everything down that you're doing right now. Go order a bunch of copies for yourself, your family, and more importantly, any elected Republican official that you know, any conservative with any amount of power in the country, and start sending them off so they do the right thing from the beginning. And stick with us, because now we're going to go into the modern philosophers, Hobbes and Locke. Oh, my gosh, this is tough stuff. Dr. Larry Arnn is my guest. He is the president of Hillsdale College. All these conversations are collected at hughforhillsdale.com. Everything Hillsdale at hillsdale.edu. But I'm telling you, this is tough stuff.
Dr. Arnn, I don't think you can make these guys interesting, Hobbes and Locke. That's who we're going to cover now. And you left off Milton, who might have made it possible to make Hobbes interesting. I have always hated Thomas Hobbes, and I know I'm with a guilty conscience. I'm supposed to love Locke, but I can't for the life of me read him without falling asleep. Explain to us Hobbes and Locke.
Well, first of all, I'm going to try to ungroup those two, because I think they should be ungrouped. But, you know, they are actually riveting reading. Hobbes' Leviathan is an amazing piece of writing, and it's a historic piece of writing. It is like Machiavelli without quite the poetic force, but it is a drama. It is a very dramatic and powerful attack upon the world as it has been conceived before the modern philosophy. Early in the book, there's a chapter called Of Reason, and he says there that reason, then, is but a scout or a spy to range abroad and find the way to the thing desired. Now, I'm quoting that from memory, but I can remember when I first read that and I went, wow. Because you see, one of the things that's going on in modern philosophy, especially in the early part of it, is if we're going to shift our focus from how men ought to be to how they are, then it naturally comes up that what we should be thinking about is what they want. And in Hobbes, it is systematic that your rational faculty is a servant of your passions. It is a reversal of the classical doctrine that happiness comes from virtue, and virtue consists specifically in the subordination of the passions to the reason. And so the world is turned upside down in Hobbes. The divine, otherworldly things, they become, in the Leviathan, spirits invisible. They're like ghosts and haunts and haints. And it is, you know, he gives an example once of what war among rational people would be like, people who really understood their self-interest, their enlightened self-interest. They would understand that the most fearsome thing is violent death and the thing most to be avoided. And so in a war, if rational people were the soldiers, a picture of war would be two armies running from one another as fast as they could go.
Hmm.
Now, that is a remarkable thing to be writing. I mean, think now, you know. We've been, you know, you have to restore the moral perspective here. We have had our fellow citizens slaughtered in their thousands and cremated in a fire that only went out a few days ago that darkened the skies of New York and put a stench in the air for weeks. That is a vile and frightful thing to do to men, women, and children alike. And thank God we have people who are prepared to go up the stairs to save their lives, or who are prepared to go to Afghanistan and hunt in those caves until they kill that man who did that thing. Well, That is not the perspective of Thomas Hobbes.
Yes, it's not. No, it's
and
not.
He makes a heck of an argument for his point of view.
Well, then, it summarizes point of view, then. We ought to all be willing to give in and give over to someone who will keep us safe.
That's it. And, you know, the Leviathan is an argument for a dictatorship designed to preserve our security. And that is a consonant with, because remember, one of the things that's going on in early modern philosophy, not so much in Machiavelli, because Machiavelli is very warlike and a very spirited man. Harvey Mansfield, you know, whom we've referred to before, he regards it as an important thing to do to recover some of the spirit of Machiavelli as a way to offset some of the influence of Thomas Hobbes that may be among us. Some of this attempt as a political, as an act of political education to make us fearful, to dominate our lives with our fears, and to excuse or to demote and to put in the bag our connection with God and with all of the higher things that are above us. So Hobbes is terribly important. And, you know, excuse me, I'll just say, I found Hobbes, that was one of the early books that I found, you know, great books that I found riveting to read. I do believe he is.
You could not say that about the Second Treatise on Government, though.
Well...
Come on, you can't say it.
That's a terribly important book.
Well, you didn't say that it was riveting, though.
No, I have not found Locke so riveting as Hobbes. That's true. I have not. But he's better.
Why bother with Locke?
Yeah.
When we can go right to the framers.
Well, because I have a good friend named Thomas West, and he's very wise. And he has, if you go to the website of the Family Research Council, you can find his Witherspoon lecture on John Locke, and it's an excellent piece of reading. And I agree with it. I believe he's carried off something that I have for years urged him not to do in using almost exactly the phrase that you have used. Locke is either part of this conspiracy that's going on with Machiavelli and Bacon and Hobbes and some others, or he's not. And he was very influential on the American Revolution. And so the question would be, is America in its essence and finally low? There is that argument out there. And their love of Locke, whom they always called the Great Locke, he was undoubtedly the most influential of the philosophers upon them. And there are two ways you can deal with that, or there are three ways. You could agree with it, but in my opinion, that doesn't make the first bit of sense, for one reason, because we've always been such good warriors. And, of course, our ideal American, the American, is George Washington, who was brave. I mean, among other things, he was massively brave. He was the magnanimous man, Aristotle's description of the man of perfect virtue. And so I don't believe you can just agree that we're a bunch of Lockeans in the low understanding of Locke. Then the question arises, how do you cope if you don't agree? And there are two ways that I can think of. And one is you can say that the Americans were practical men, and they weren't the slave of any philosopher. They were students of the political things just as much as Pericles or Themistocles in ancient Greece. And they contrived a political system that was in conformity with the natural political things they saw around them as those things had been qualified and modified by the birth of Jesus and monotheism. That's one way to go. I have always preferred that way. I think it's true. But Tom West, on the other hand, who's a theoretic man of real ability, wants to redeem Locke. He's not alone in that. There's also Nathan Tarkov at Chicago, who's more or less of this view. I hesitate to speak for him. But he's a sophisticated man and a fine Locke scholar, and I've heard him make arguments similar to those that Tom West makes. Now, what they dwell on when they make these arguments, I'll read you a quote from Locke, if I can find the darn thing. Nature, I confess, has put into man a desire of happiness and an aversion to misery. Principles of actions, indeed, there are lodged in men's appetites. But these are so far from being innate moral principles that if they were left to their full swing, they would carry men to the overturning of all morality. Moral laws are set as a curb and restraint to these exorbitant desires.
Well, so what's that mean? What's that supposed to mean to us?
Well, what it's supposed to mean is, this is not, excuse me, I got a coughing spell here. This is not a man who is going down the road that Thomas Hobbes indicated, where if we but govern ourselves by giving rein to our strongest passions, we will have at last a peaceful society and harmonious under the thumb of an all-powerful ruler. This is a man who's giving a richer and broader picture of human nature, who understands that we do have these appetites, but if we liberate them and follow them anywhere they will take us, they will destroy us. What must curb those is a moral law, that is to say, a looking up and beyond ourselves.
When we come back, Dr. Arnn, we're going to turn to someone who actually is fun to read. No matter what he says, America, I'm warning you, if you pick up the second treatise, you're in for a really long haul. But Rousseau, well, he's a lot of fun, very mischievous. When we return, we go to the French with Dr. Larry Arnn in this special edition of The Hugh Hewitt Show. Welcome back, America. This is Hugh Hewitt on a special edition of The Hugh Hewitt Show, taped originally for broadcast on December 31st, 2001, January 1, 2002. With Dr. Larry Arnn, president of Hillsdale College. If you want a little bit of Hillsdale, you call 1-800-437-2268. Ask to be put on the Imprimist mailing list. Once a month, you will get absolutely scot-free, in honor of Mr. Hobbes, a edition of a great speech or work of intellect. Now, Dr. Arnn, Rousseau, you didn't even put on your little cheat sheet you sent me the Confessions, which really makes him fun. instead, you put Emile on here. I once had Alan Bloom come when I was undergraduate, and they herded us all into a room, and he delivered of himself a two-hour lecture on the Emile that not any of us understood three words of. And so I'm for the Confessions, I'm against Emile. So explain Rousseau and why we have to like him.
Well, I think we should abstract from the debate between pleasure and stern discipline the wrong side of which you have taken.
I have.
Let's talk about the discourses.
Okay.
Rousseau is a very lively writer. He's interested in the pleasures. Confessions of a Solitary is a very interesting thing where the kind of deepest kind of contemplation is lying in a boat, looking up at the sky and on a pretty day and watching the clouds. And so you're in a boat and it's just drifting. And the sky above is your, and the sweet sentiment of existence comes over you. It's sort of French.
Very.
There are two things to remark in his discourses that seem to me profoundly important for what comes after him. One is the concept of malleability. Human beings are malleable. That's a French term, of course, and it means that they can be changed. Language itself is an invention or an artifice. Remember that the classical definition of the human being is that the human being is the beast that talks. It has language because the language requires reason. And that's what we have that makes us different from the other creatures. Well, in Rousseau, that becomes artificial. That develops over time. And that means that we are evolving in some sense. He doesn't have a doctrine of evolution, but he has a doctrine of artifice, of change with time. And that ties into the second thing, which is what he calls the general will. The general will later becomes influential with John C. Calhoun and some American authors, but also with the German historicist, as does malleability. And there the idea is that our will, you see, that is to say, what we wish for, what we intend, becomes the measure of our politics. And the way you get harmonious politics, you know, he begins the discourse with men are born free but everywhere in chains. Why is that? I don't know, but what can be done about it? This is a 20-year-old memory I'm giving you now, and I apologize to every American who hears this for that, even every foreigner. But it's roughly that. What can be done about it? I think I can say. Well, the point is that you have to build a general will. We have to all wish for the same thing. So it becomes an act of statesmanship, a purpose of government, to get people wishing for the same thing, control of our wishes. And if you put those two doctrines together, you can see, if you understand them in just the right way, that this might give a very wide scope.
This might lead to the French Revolution. It might lead to Marx. It might lead to Lenin.
That's it.
It could lead to all sorts of bad things, as indeed it did lead to all sorts of bad things. More coming up with Dr. Larry on in this first broadcast day of the year. All of this conversation is collected at HughForHillsdale.com. There's a button for HughForHillsdale.com that connects you up to the 4 years of Hillsdale Dialogues over at HughHewitt.com. I encourage you to go over there, also to Hillsdale.edu for their wonderful online courses taught by Dr. Arnn's colleagues up at the Lantern of the North, Hillsdale College. But I also encourage you, when you're over at HughHewitt.com looking for the button for the Hillsdale Dialogues, that you hit the button for my brand new book, The Fourth Way, A Conservative Playbook to a Lasting Republican Majority. The Fourth Way, most important book I have ever written, and now we need it. The new year is upon us. We've got to roll out and get this thing going and get it done the right way. Read it. Advocate for it. It is the blueprint that we need. Team Trump's a little confused about what to do. Well, The Fourth Way will tell them what to do and how to do it. Stay tuned, America. It is the Hugh Hewitt Show, beginning of the new year. Welcome back, America. It's Hugh Hewitt with Dr. Larry Arnn, president of Hillsdale College. It's the first broadcast day of the year. We began the last broadcast day of the year marching through the ideas of Western civilization. And we're almost done. We have another hour and a half of them with Dr. Larry Arnn. All of these discussions are collected at HughForHillsdale.com, Hillsdale.edu. There's a link at HughHewitt.com, as there is to my brand new book, The Fourth Way. Go and get both of them, and stay tuned. Dr. Arnn, welcome back.
He launches, really, the idea that we can, that a small group of people can mold and socially engineer a group of people into all wanting the same thing and achieving utopia.
And I just would like to comment to the people that we have taped the first of these just before Christmas, and the second of them just after Christmas, and Mr. Hewitt seemed liberated to talk more of pleasure this second.
Well, I do want to warn people about Rousseau, because he is very much a college phenomenon. I mean, like Nietzsche, young people are drawn to him for his optimism about the ability to achieve this utopia. You're skeptical of him.
Well, I studied Rousseau and Nietzsche with and Hobbes with Harry Newman, who teaches in— he's very ill now, I understand, who teaches in Claremont, a great teacher, one of the most thorough and systematic and insightful men I ever met in my life. And I owe a lot of my education to him, although not my errors, which I'm compounding by the minute here. He was a wonderful teacher, both of Rousseau and of Nietzsche. And we would read these things like The Man in the Boat that I just described. I think the last time I read that, I was sitting in his class, and that was 27 years ago or so. You do see the power of it. It is, you know, it is true. I mean, does not every listener remember being a child lying on the ground in the grass, looking up at the sky, and feeling wonderful by the experience? Imagine the same thing, except lying in a boat where you're not even controlling where you go. You might just drift anywhere. See, that is the intoxicating power of Rousseau.
Now, you just, by the way, almost casually grouped the people. You grouped Rousseau and Nietzsche and Hobbes, and my guess would be you would throw in Machiavelli and Marx, and
yes,
there we would have the bad men. Am I right?
Yeah, I guess so.
And so what makes them bad? I mean, in essence, what makes those the bad people?
Well, you know, the problem with ancient philosophy is that it doesn't seem to get anywhere, because there are just these questions. But that's sort of what life is like, isn't it? I mean, you have these things that face you, and you are called to figure them out. But they tend to be hard to figure out. Have you had a loved one taken young? Why does that happen? Why is that right? What does right have to do with it? People of faith, they have to ask themselves the question. You know, one of the differences between Protestantism and Catholicism in the classic sense in the Reformation is the doctrine of purgatory. Well, purgatory, which has some basis in the book of Revelation, I think, and I'm not professing myself a believer in that here, but there's something there to it. Purgatory, among other things, is a way to sort of bring one of the teachings of the Scripture, which is a blessed thing, but also confusing in some context, into accord with our own natural sense of justice. What if it's true that Ted Bundy, who murdered all those people, had a conversion at the last minute and went to heaven? Whereas somebody who'd done good works all his life but rejected Jesus goes to hell. Well, purgatory sort of adds a step on the way, where there can be some more punishment to kind of make it a little more right.
We now tackle a pair of economists, Adam Smith and Karl Marx. The former, a good, sturdy Scotsman. The latter, a denizen of the British Library, in which Dr. Arne introduced me by way of a lending card once to the old reading room, and I thank you for that. Why do we need to even know these two people, and are they indeed the alpha and the omega of economics?
Smith is a moral philosopher. One of his key works is The Theory of Moral Sentiments, and there he comes up with a theory of the human being grounded in his sympathies. We could talk about that for a long time. It's very interesting, and the great Joseph Cropsey has written his doctoral thesis on that, and it's well worth reading. More famous in Smith is his preparation of the ground for modern economics. He gives an explanation, the first great explanation, and this is, by the way, about the time of the American Revolution, for why it is that a market economy works, why it leads to freedom as well as prosperity. And this turns out to be a terribly important thing. He is, you know, the inventor of the conception of the invisible hand. My friend Stan Evans likes to tell a great joke about how libertarian he is. He says he resents the invisible hand. It's too intrusive. But what is meant by that expression is that human beings, one of the manifestations of their natural gregariousness is they trade and cooperate with each other. If you leave the process to work, it is surprising how well it will work as if it were guided by a single hand. And that is one of the fundamentals of the achievement of freedom, which is necessary, in my opinion, in the modern world. And the market economy is vital to it. It cannot be done if the common political power controls the property of the land. Essentially, there will be no scope for private freedom.
Mm-hmm.
That goes along with their control of religion would be the same thing, or their control of the family would be the same thing. And Smith, in The Wealth of Nations, explains why this works and how it works and that it works. And that proves to be a terribly important work. Now, Marx is a different sort of thing altogether. But to talk about Marx, you see, I think it's true of both Smith and Marx that they're not mainly economists. That's not what they think they are, and that's not really what their works are like. Both of them are trying to explain something. Both of them, in different ways, are trying to explain why things are as they are and how they are. Marx is trying to explain how they are as a process of change over time. And his belief is that things change because of material causes. In the end, the human soul itself disappears because it is a product of material causes. Aristotle's doctrine had been that the soul must be nothing. It must not have any matter in it whatsoever, which means it cannot occupy a place. And that is the condition of understanding. That is the condition of freedom. Marx's idea is the opposite of that. Marx's idea, if you go back to, and you think of the concentration on things of this world, adding in Rousseau's idea that the human being develops and that language itself is artificial, then the question becomes, how does it develop? What is the process by which it develops? And in Marx, you get the most rigorous, clear, rigid kind of explanation in the Communist Manifesto and in Capital. And these are very detailed. The Capital is a terribly, frightfully
dense
German kind of work.
Yes.
And it's very hard to read, and it's very detailed. And what he describes is a process, somehow latent in history, by which the means of production shape us into conflicts with each other. And these conflicts give rise to new developments and further conflicts until the time comes when we make the leap into perfect freedom. We have heaven on earth then. So this concentration of the things here on earth come to mean, in Marx, a utopia on earth here, in which we are all radically free.
Charles Darwin and Friedrich Nietzsche, and our guest, Dr. Larry Arne, is going to explain it all to us. Darwin, of course, well known to everyone as the author of The Origin of the Species and the launcher of so many conflicts. What do we need to know about him?
Well, Darwin was a biologist. He went to the Galapagos Islands, and he conceived the idea that the species evolve one from the next. He found this confined ecology or system of life there, and environment of life, and he decided that one had come from another. And the power of this comes from the fact that it is tied to this modern historicism that is full blown in Marx, and it comes to be a proof. It purports to be a scientific proof that we are in fact evolutionary creatures, which means that we lack a nature. We are not a particular thing. We are a way station between one thing and another thing. And there's a lot of interesting things going on right now about Darwin. There's a lot of debate about him, of course. It's always seemed to me, by the way, that in one way the solution to the problem posed by Darwin is very simple. If it were true that our nature, that who we are, is defined by a material process, that would mean that our soul was somehow overwhelmed or dominated by a material process. But if that were true, we could not have objective knowledge of it. It's the same problem of understanding that Marx faces when he says that our consciousness is set by a historical period. And then the question rises, okay, then how do you know that? Mm-hmm. Aren't you just determined by history to think what you think? And of course, he's a very clever man. I mean, he's more than that. He's a brilliant man. I'm trying to work up some words of respect for Marx, and I've been taught to do that, but it's hard for me. But he has an out, and that is, well, I just stand at that moment in history where you can see it all.
Where you can, yeah.
Yeah, I'm exempt. Well, Darwin has the same problem, depending on how you understand him. And there are two things going on in the study of Darwin that are interesting to me. One is there's a group of people called the intelligent design types, and what they think is Darwin's a bunch of rubbish, at least the largest and broadest claims made in regard to him. But B, if you look about the world, what you'll see is evidence all over the place of design. Of, if you walk down a beach and you see a pile of rocks, you think maybe they just got, depending on how they're conformed, you think maybe they just got washed up. But if you see a wristwatch, you'll think somebody made it, and it looks designed. And one pile of rocks might look undesigned and another designed. And if you look at the universe, you'll see evidence of design. And they are big critics of Darwin, and they're qualified biologists, a lot of them really smart, and their arguments are interesting to me. Another is a fellow named Larry Arnhart, who's writing books about Darwin, associating him with Aristotle. I haven't read his book yet, but I know him and have heard him talk about it a couple times and have some understanding of what he has to say. And his idea is really to save Darwin from the charge that he is a materialist in this sense of modern intellectual historicism. And I just say that all those things are interesting. It seems plain to me that this, as I say, that this larger claim about Darwin, that he proves that we are evolutionary creatures, cannot be true. Because if we were, it would be something materialist about us that would make us think that he had proved that.
Stay right there, America. We got to come back to this. This is a controversial bit of Dr. Arnn's presentation. And it always is. First broadcast day of the year, we're talking about Darwin, so we're shaking you up. We're talking about everything that has made Western civilization what is Western civilization. Dr. Arnn, of course, the president of Hillsdale College, all of these dialogues in the last broadcast hour of each week are collected at hughforhillsdale.com. Everything Hillsdale collected at hillsdale.edu. So if you head over, the link, by the way, to that, if you can't remember, is at hughhewitt.com. And be sure and go and order my brand new book, The Fourth Way, a conservative playbook to a lasting Republican majority. The Fourth Way, most important book I've ever written. You've got to go and get it for you and your family and all of your friends, and especially any elected Republican you know. Stay tuned. I'll be right back with Dr. Larry Arnn on this, the first broadcast day of the new year. It's the Hugh Hewitt Show. Welcome back, America. Good morning. I am starting your new year with a dash through the ideas that have shaped all the centuries before us and will shape this brand new century and this brand new presidency, and with Dr. Larry Arnn, president of Hillsdale College. And we have not much time to conclude. Darwin unleashed all sorts of terrible things upon this century. The worst of things, terrible things. By the way, all of the previous hours collected at hughforhillsdale.com over at Hugh Hewitt. Dr. Arnn, we go back to Darwin.
He also unleashed upon the world a whole bunch of terrible political theory, or at least people who consider themselves to be political theorists, about the right to rule and the necessity of superiority ruling and of radical inequality among humans.
Yeah, it's kind of let the best man win, taken to savage extreme.
That's right.
And that's right. That's in there, too. It's not, you don't get a picture of nature as kindly in Darwin. Of course, it isn't all kindly. It is both kindly and not kindly. The wolf eats the rabbit, but it also fights to defend its young. It is, I guess there's this guy, maybe his name is, I think his name is Dawkins, and he's a really smart fellow from...
Richard Dawkins, Selfish Gene.
Yes. Yeah, right. And he's a great, you know, I've seen him interviewed twice. I've not read anything he wrote, acting on my theory that you can only know a few things well. Why waste time on him? But, excuse me, Mr. Dawkins, I don't know you, but I must say I haven't liked what I've heard him say. And he sort of sits there smugly, you know, and takes great comfort from the idea that, you know, Darwin is true and ain't that great.
Okay, now listen, we're going to have to do Nietzsche. And all I can remember about Nietzsche is that when Alan Keyes, our friend, told me he first encountered Nietzsche, he was speechless for a day. He read Zarathustra and was just, in the way that Ayn Rand novel will sometimes reduce a young person to inaction, he was struck down by Zarathustra. What do we need to know about Nietzsche?
Okay, Nietzsche is a great German poet. He comes after the doctrine of historicism, philosophic doctrine of historicism, has become full-blown. And in a fashion, he rebels against it. He wishes to recover the greatness of the man, in part. He has the theory of the Overman, the Übermensch, and Zarathustra is a character in what is probably Nietzsche's greatest book, and Zarathustra is a kind of a preparation for this Übermensch, and he thinks he wants to recover greatness. He's sick of this process, and also of Hegel's theory of the state, in which lots of competing groups join together to rule and work out a consensus. To him, the regimes produced by that are the regimes of the last men, who seek to huddle together for warmth and comfort and have no boldness and no spirit in them.
We are closing this hour with a look at Nietzsche, the German who warned of men without chests. What did he mean by that?
Well, what he meant was that these various strains in modern philosophy, from Hobbes and maybe Locke and from Marx and Hegel, that what they were producing was men without chest, men who had no muscle, no bone, no strength and boldness, no greatness to them. And Nietzsche certainly wished to restore that. He wished to restore that in philosophy. He wished for a comprehensive understanding again. He was very interested in the classics, Nietzsche. In a certain way, he did something, some parts of something that Leo Strauss also pursued, and that was he looked at it all and said, this is not working that well. Maybe we should start over again. These doctrines are low, and we need better ones. And so he did a lot of reading of the classics, and he read them with an unusually intelligent eye. In the end, he comes up with this doctrine called the eternal return. And in a certain way, that's a historical process that's not a historical process. At the end of history, what comes for Nietzsche is the ability to accept and to thereby to transcend everything. The great moment at the end is not a moment of individual will and individual comfort and individual life. The great moment at the end produces the great man. And Nietzsche's works, especially the Zarathustra, but also Beyond Good and Evil, and they're all like this. They all are seeking, first of all, to explain how we got where we got, and to offer an alternative, which becomes mostly a poetic kind of an alternative. It's very powerful. I remember when I first got to graduate school, a man who was in those days infinitely older than I, although he's really only 3 or 4 years older, but he was 3 or 4 years older in graduate school. Peter Schramm is his name. I said to him once, I said, when we were in the middle of these great Nietzsche courses that Harry Newman would teach, I said, why did Nietzsche go crazy? And Peter looked at me and said, wouldn't you?
On that note, we're concluding hour six, and we are hour five, and we're preparing for hour six. Really, everything has been a preparation for hour six. It's the American founding, and it is Jefferson and Washington, Lincoln and Churchill, with a man who spent most of his life in their acquaintance. So don't go anywhere. You're listening to the special New Year's edition of The Hugh Hewitt Show. Stay tuned.
Morning glory, America. So good that you are up early across the United States. Some of you are going to work today. Most of you are not. Some of you are listening at home. It's the first broadcast day of the year. It is our tradition to always march through the ideas of the West to get you started on the right way with Dr. Larry Arnn, president of Hillsdale College. All these dialogues are collected at HughForHillsdale.com. It's your New Year's resolution. Go over there and binge listen. Another New Year's resolution you have to make, go to HughHewitt.com and order my new book, The Fourth Way. This is just a naked pitch, a naked appeal. We've got to get the Republicans to do the right thing so we do not screw it up again. That we've got to hold on to power long enough to repopulate the federal judiciary. We've got to rebuild the military. We've got to get the tax policy right. We've got to roll back the regulatory state. All of that and how to do it collected at The Fourth Way, a conservative playbook to a lasting Republican majority. The Fourth Way is linked at HughHewitt.com. And I am with Dr. Larry Arnn talking about now we are finally to the American experience.
We're in the American founding. And in this hour, we're covering just four people, but such four people, Washington, Jefferson, Lincoln, and Churchill. It seems to me, Dr. Arnn, that this is a part where everyone's going to have some familiarity, but it's fallen on hard times in recent years as to why it matters what these people did. Why don't we start there? Why do we even care what these people in funny suits wrote about in 1776? After all, we have the Supreme Court, and they tell us what we need to know now.
Yeah, there you go. Well, the answer to that question is contained in the decisions written by the Supreme Court of the United States. Just read one of them sometime and you'll figure out maybe somebody must have been pretty good to make all this. But that reaches to a serious point, which is if you wish to be a student of important things, you're bound to have to study politics because, as I said at the beginning of this, political things always turn upon claims about what constitutes good and bad, right and wrong. And these claims are the most authoritative here on Earth. They have the power of a monopoly on force behind them. And so in the history of the great political things, America is, by any standard, one of the great nations. It is the successor to the Roman and the British empires. Today, anywhere in the world where there's a problem, the question arises, ought we to solve it? Because if it cannot be solved locally, then it cannot be solved without our help or permission or both. We are a great people. We dominate the world. We have a record of written constitutional history that is longer than any people ever. The forms of our Constitution, although challenged in my opinion, and the cause of that challenge is a great crisis, I believe, the one that we face in our time, still those forms operate. Still, it's true that the president stands up every 4 years and takes an oath, and it's the same oath that all the ones before him took. And still, it's true that they all deliver a speech, and when they deliver the speech, they all try to make it consonant in some sense with that first inaugural address given by George Washington 200-some years ago. So it's important to try to give an account of yourself, of what does your country mean, and what is it about it that is its excellence. And it seems to me that in the lives of these four men, one of them only half American, so far as biography is concerned, you can give that account.
Why do you want to begin with Jefferson? Your list began with Jefferson and not with Washington.
Well, because Jefferson wrote the Declaration of Independence, and that's why he should be here. And it all begins with the Declaration of Independence. And it's really more important to talk about Jefferson's product than it is about Jefferson, the producer of it. He was the main author, not the only one, of the Declaration. And the Declaration is a unique document in political history. It's the first time that a people ever started a country on the basis of a document giving the reasons for the country. And those reasons fit wonderfully in this long sweep that we've been undertaking. In my opinion, and in the opinion of the people who taught me, this document constitutes a practical in some ways and a theoretical in other ways solution to some of the problems that are raised by what we've been talking about. You have the problem that in the ancient world the law was a particular thing growing out of the people and especially the gods of each individual place. But now we have monotheism. And so in a world where the law is delivered from God to a class of people who are his representatives on earth, what kind of government will you get from that? And in a way, the Reformation and Luther and Machiavelli, in a different way, are all commentators on that question. And they, what they think is that in such a conception, you will get despotism. That doesn't by itself mean any rebellion against Jesus, because Jesus is a unique figure in many ways, but in one that he was not a founder of a nation. He didn't govern. He didn't form an army and attack anybody. Mostly his statements and the statements of his apostles and the authors of the New Testament about politics are that you should obey what's there. So something new had to be worked out. And in the end, what was worked out above all and best in the Declaration of Independence. There, a political system is built to recognize our rights, which include our right to worship. And these rights, however, do not destroy what is called the laws of nature and of nature's God. Rights in that document do not destroy right. And so we have the volition to govern ourselves as we choose, but how we choose is judged by a higher power than we, and if we disobey that power, others are then justified in doing what we do with the Declaration of Independence in rebelling.
Now, the two objections, and I, by the way, have put both of these objections to your professor, Professor Jaffa, on our annual 4th of July broadcast on this program. The two objections, of course, is one, when Jefferson refers to nature's God, he doesn't really believe in nature's God. He doesn't believe in God. He believes in Thomas Jefferson's intellect. And the other is that all well and good, but the man owns slaves, so it's all a bunch of balderdash.
Well, the first thing is, it's certainly not true that Thomas Jefferson believed in Thomas Jefferson's intellect. He believed what he writes and what he says privately is he believes in a natural world available to the intellect. What he believes about God is controversial, by the way. He does, for example, in an interesting point on the question of separation of church and state, he did, as president, attend services faithfully held every Sunday morning in the chamber of the United States House of Representatives, Christian services. But Jefferson, I do not believe that there's any ground for doubt that Jefferson believed that these laws of nature and of nature's God were perceivable by every person and established in nature. That, I believe, he believed with perfect firmness, and that they are a summary of what you might call the moral law, right and wrong, doing the right thing, not stealing, not cheating, not lying, such as that, and that that law was the law that condemned George III. It's interesting, you see, that they took the trouble when they're writing this letter of rebellion to the most powerful man on earth, to call upon a standard, not just their will, by which they would exercise this rebellion.
They gave an account and they listed his crimes.
That's right. And so, remember, it's not an act of will. It's the purpose of the Declaration. Because you could just write and say, get out of here, buddy. We're tired of you. We will not have you anymore. That's not what they do. What they do is itself an act of sacrifice. First, an act of obedience to these laws of nature and of nature's God. Second, a statement of what they are so that the candid world to which they refer in the document can also make their own judgments fairly. And then finally, at the end, a pledge, each one, that they must to each other give every valuable thing that they have of their own, not including they don't promise to sacrifice their families, but their fortunes, their lives, and their sacred honor, they do promise. So that document, and remember there's a solution.
Why is it important for you to make that note that they did not pledge their families?
Well, they don't promise the life of any other, just their own lives. You see,
they
promise only what's theirs.
We only have a minute to the break, and we'll come back to Jefferson after the break. But we do have, in the postmodern world, the ultimate sin is hypocrisy. And you have yet to cross that bridge of the problem of slavery in Jefferson's own life.
Well, hypocrisy, another word for it, is vice-flattering virtue. So hypocrisy is actually better than open vice. So I don't condemn it in the same way. But also, these people were not hypocrites. They themselves were practicers of and condemners of slavery. And they themselves were urgently involved in the task of figuring out what on earth to do about that. Because, of course, slavery had been the rule everywhere before them, and they had to find a way to get rid of it. They adopted the principles that made it ultimately, once those principles were vindicated, necessary to get rid of it.
When we come back, we stay a bit with Thomas Jefferson before we move on to George Washington, who may not be in vogue, but is really ought to be. You're listening to part six of the special edition, New Year's Day edition of The Hugh Hewitt Show. Welcome back, America. Hugh Hewitt, part six of this special edition of The Hugh Hewitt Show, originally broadcast on December 31st, 2001, January 1st, 2002, to launch your New Year's resolutions on a good path by updating you on everything you missed or slept through in the course of your Western Civ many, many years ago. Our guide through this, Dr. Larry Arn, president of Hillsdale College. And if you want to continue to get a little bit of Hillsdale every month, then you can get free of charge obligation and they will never sell your address. Imprimis, that is the newsletter of Hillsdale College, which excerpts great speeches and intellectual controversies once a month. You can get that by calling 1-800-437-2268. 1.2 million Americans get that every single month. You can join those and at least be on the same page with most of thinking America. 1-800-437-2268. Dr. Arn, we were talking about Jefferson. And before we move on to Washington, I have to ask you, why even care about the Declaration after all the Constitution came after it and sort of replaced it as the governing ordinance of the country? At least that's what Justice Rehnquist tells us, and Judge Bork.
Well, they make an error there. The Declaration was not a form of government, although it implied one. The Declaration was a statement of the reasons for government, and in particular for our government. The Constitution gives form to that. Now, the Constitution does have in its text three places where it protects human slavery. And in order to understand that those are compromises of necessity rather than assertions of what is good, you have to understand the connection between the Constitution and the principles of liberty. And those principles are stated in the Declaration of Independence. We did get this doctrine in the second law that the Supreme Court ever overturned, Dred Scott versus Sanford, that the doctrine of the Constitution was that the black man had no rights that the white man was bound to respect. You can't find any authoritative person in the making of the Revolution, either the Declaration, the War, or the Constitution, who believed that. That's not what they said. What they said was slavery is wrong, and we have to find a way to get rid of it. Now, that, it seems to me that these two documents have to be understood together. And they are both essential. And the idea that you could abstract from the one to the other seems to me foolish.
When do the students of Hillsdale read the Declaration?
They read that in their first year, in the second semester under American Heritage.
Interesting. You wait until the second semester then?
Well, it's just because we do West, we do the old stuff. We go sort of go in chronological order.
All right. I want to turn now to Washington, because after the break, we're going to do Lincoln, and that will take two segments, and we're going to mix Churchill in with that. But Washington is often overlooked in a hurry up because, in many respects, he's not very modern. He's just not very dashing, though he is the soul of courage and physical bravery. What do we need to know about him?
Well, first of all, he was very dashing. He was one of the most handsome men ever born, one of my high pleasures. Being a president of a college is, I have this great sculptor here. His name is Tony Frudakis, and he wins awards for his sculptings. And so he's working on George Washington, of course. We're going to have a 7-foot bronze of George Washington on this campus. Also Churchill and Lincoln and Thatcher and Reagan, a few of them. George Washington is gorgeous. Abigail Adams said of him when writing to her husband when she first met him, "I was not told the half." I doubted when I saw the 24-inch clay of this thing that will become a big bronze, that he could have been so handsome. But Tony Frudakis produced a life mask made in plaster of Washington's face. He's a gorgeous man. He's very big. He was a fabulous horseman. He looked wonderful on a horse. everything about him spoke of rule, self-control as the fundamental basis of it. He had this massive self-control. He kept himself, he was very funny. He loved to laugh and tell jokes. He loved to talk to the ladies in the evening at dinners and things. He was a very circumspect man. And don't let about any time you talk about a statesman talking to ladies these days, you think they're doing something improper. He did not. He had a very powerful temper, which came out only a few times. And the most perceptive observers understood that his self-control was in part that great virtue that everyone should cultivate, but also it began in necessity, because he could blow up. And what he ultimately did, of course, was blow up a continent.
He blew up history, actually. George Washington, the founder of the country, the father of the country. More on the framers and the founders. All this collected, by the way, at HubertHillsdale.com, over at HughHewitt.com. While you are there, the button that will take you there, you'll see next to it my brand new book, The Fourth Way. Go and get that book today, because we got to get the Republicans off to the start that George Washington got this country off to the start on as well. A great one. Stay tuned. I'll be right back with Dr. Arnn on The Hugh Hewitt Show. Welcome back, America. It's Hugh Hewitt, first broadcast day of the year. Happy New Year to you. Dr. Larry Arnn welcoming in the new year with me, president of Hillsdale College. All of my conversations with Dr. Arnn collected at HughForHillsdale.com. We're talking about one of our favorite subjects, George Washington, and specifically George Washington as a commander in the field of an army exposed to fire. It's really quite an extraordinary story, Dr. Arnn.
There are two places where, in the war, where he changed the course of a battle by his presence and his actions. At Princeton and at Monmouth, in both cases, the American army was running away, and he waded into the middle of it, directly toward the British. In one case, just riding his horse forward. In another case, shouting and commanding, in a few cases, whipping the men. And in both cases, they turned and fought. And in the Battle of Princeton, the British more or less ran away from him. He gave these commands to fire, standing between the two armies. And when the smoke had cleared, there's an account of this from a Colonel Fitzwilliam, who was one of his adjutants who was there. They all thought he was dead, but he was standing exactly where he had been. And he just was unshaken by the experience.
Now, I would impose on you for the story about removing his glasses and growing old in the service of the country, because I heard you say it once in a remarks, and it's a powerful anecdote.
Well, at Newburgh, you know, after the Battle of Yorktown, these people who had been a rabble fleeing from the most disciplined army in the world had beaten them and had become a wonderful army. And Congress was then, as it is now and ever will be, stupid and awkward. Not corrupt, you know, but stupid and awkward. You know, it's a big bunch of people, and they never can agree. So one of the ways in which they manifested their character was in not paying the soldiers who had given them a country to govern. So the soldiers were in a state of rebellion. They had the idea of marching off to the West and leaving everybody to their own devices. it's like a huge martial pout. But, you know, justified. And then they had the idea of sending a demand on the civil government. So Washington heard of this, and first he delayed the meeting, then he let them schedule it, and then he went, showed up by surprise, and he walks up to the front of them and asks if he can speak. Of course, already he has become what he will prove to be, the greatest American. I mean, Thomas Jefferson and James Madison and Alexander Hamilton and John Adams and Patrick Henry, and none of them could run for president against him. It's not possible. He's overwhelming, you know. So he goes up to the front, and he takes out his glasses and says, he was going to read. He says, "Excuse me," he says, "I've grown old serving in your company." And he gives them this beautiful speech. And in it, he establishes two things. You are the servants of the civil government. That's the first. And the second is, I am your servant. I, in this matter of your pay, will be your servant.
We were just talking, President Arnn, about Washington quelling a rebellion among the Revolutionary Army, the Army, Continental Army. But he also did another amazing thing. He laid down power. And before we move on to Lincoln, the significance of that.
Well, there's that great story, you know, where the Prime Minister was speaking to George III, who could not be brought to call the peace conference after Yorktown. He had lost the New World, you know. Oops. And one day he looked up, and he said to the prime minister, he said, you know, Washington does not know how to be a king. He will be a tyrant, and the people will want me back. And the prime minister replied, sir, I understand that General Washington is retiring and going home. And the king visibly started. You know, what does a conqueror do, you see?
Mm-hmm.
He took it for granted. And he replied, if he does that, he's the greatest living man.
George III is reported to have said that?
Yes.
I was unaware of that. That's an amazing story.
He did. Washington did that on two occasions. And you know, you talk about the greatness of a man, his virtues. He's chosen because he is the sum of virtue. And he's uncontested. First, courage. You know, on a battlefield, you know, mad Anthony Wayne, you know, he's crazy. You know, he couldn't stop himself from throwing himself physically, bodily, upon the enemy. He thought George Washington was the bravest man he ever met. And so he was like that. But also his moderation, his utter trustworthiness with power. He would not abuse it. He demonstrated that over and over again. Don't pay us. I'll keep them together anyway.
Now,
and then I'll write you nice letters about how I'm working for you and mean it. You see, that if you wonder, by the way, those guys who are over there in Afghanistan right now working for us, they are the most lethal living people. Why do they work for us? If you want to meet a government official who treats you with respect as if he were your command, you were his commander, meet somebody in the military. In the post office or the DMV, they might be surly with you. A military officer is still carrying in his breast the lesson of George Washington.
I must now switch because of the pressure of time. We could spend a long time on General Washington, but we need to go to Lincoln, whom some would call the greatest American, even superior to Washington. What do we need to know about Lincoln? What do you make the young men and women of Hillsdale College read that Lincoln wrote?
Well, we read, of course, the first and second inaugural addresses, and everybody reads those. We read the Gettysburg Address. Everybody reads that. And we read in the political science department, they teach everything he wrote. And, you know, nobody ever studies him enough, in my opinion. Lincoln is he's a poet. If anybody doubts it, what you should do on Lincoln's birthday, February the 12th, is sit down and read the second inaugural address and see the biblical sense of justice that is in it. And read it through over and over until it's familiar. The Gettysburg Address is the same phenomenon. The first inaugural is a brilliant constitutional argument that I urge everyone to read. But these two things, the second inaugural and the Gettysburg Address, they're just poems. They're beautiful. He says in the second inaugural, if every drop of blood drawn by the sword, by the lash, during 200 years of the bondsman's unrequited toil, must now be repaid by another drawn by the sword, still it will be said, that the ways of God are righteous altogether. The war is seen as a visitation of justice. Now, Lincoln is this kid who grew up on a farm in poverty and toil, educated himself by firelight, knew want most of his life, and somehow he became a lawyer. He became a prosperous lawyer. He was involved in local politics. He served in Congress, didn't like it, wasn't there very long. Somehow, he became a commander of great affairs under incredible pressure. He does say, getting on the train to go to the first inaugural to Washington to take up his job, that he had before him a task greater than the task of Washington. In another place, his eulogy to Washington is just gorgeous.
Dr. Arne, Lincoln got on the train, went off to do a task greater than Washington, which was to plunge the nation into civil war. Some would argue, at least in the South, unjustly having done so.
Well, my own view of that is the true one. No, my own view is the view of the people who started this college, and I think it's true. What Lincoln, the problem that the Union faced was this, that slavery, which was, you know, operated in some ways kind of like some difficult question to operate today, maybe abortion or stem cell research or something. It's one of those unpleasant topics and nobody wants to talk about it. you know, Bill Clinton's opinion about abortion was that it should be safe, legal, and rare. You know, why rare? And, you know, it's in every eye, it is cast in some disfavor. Slavery was like that, too. It became an urgent question because of the Western lands. Because as they began to be in demand and began to be populated, the question arose, are they going to be slave or free? The people in the South, who were the slave owners, which is a minority of them, but they were a very powerful minority, they had a keen interest in it being expanded, in part because it's good economics. It you know, the slaves become more valuable if there's more land for them to work, and the land becomes cheaper if there's more land available, and so both sides of the transaction work in their favor. On the other hand, in the North, it began to become urgent for a lot of reasons, but one of them was a lot of these farmers who were going out there didn't want to have to compete with these big plantations. So it began to disturb the national mind. And the problem was that it was plain that the Declaration of Independence was meant, among other things, to be a condemnation of human slavery. But the Constitution both protected it positively in three ways, but second, it also did not give the federal government power to end it where it was. And so the Republican Party was born with a kind of a constitutional position. It figured something out. And the something was that there was a happy accident, and that is most of the land of the United States is not yet incorporated as states and is under the rule of the Congress. And so the Congress at least is not denied, but is in fact given, they believe, not explicitly, admittedly, the power to forbid it in the federal territories. And that means then that you could have a constitutional method of placing slavery, as Lincoln's phrase, in the course of ultimate extinction. Lincoln in his first inaugural says that he himself would not resist a constitutional amendment, though it would be redundant to forbid the federal government ever interfering in slavery in the states where it exists. But it must be excluded from the territories, because in that case it will remain a minority interest in the country, and ultimately a way will be found out of it.
Hmm.
That's his argument. It's a constitutional argument, and it's put with this poetic beauty. He puts it first in the Lincoln-Douglas debates in the argument with Douglas, where Douglas's view is, I care not whether slavery is voted up or voted down. His doctrine was called popular sovereignty. He thought local constituencies should be permitted to decide it on their own. He said, famously, if the good men of Nebraska are good enough to govern themselves, why are they not good enough to govern a few miserable Negroes? And Lincoln replied, they're good enough to govern themselves, but they're not good enough to do what no man is good enough to do, which is to govern another man without his consent. These arguments are wonderful expositions of the meaning of our country, and in my opinion, I'm going to stop saying that because it's just true, they constitute a revival of the doctrines that made our country what it is, and a completion of the work that was begun with the American Revolution. And Abraham Lincoln, this little farm boy country lawyer, is the man that God appointed to bring those arguments to life.
God appointed. That means with a divine hand doing the appointing. More on Lincoln and what transpired in the American continent after he repaired the damage, original damage in the Constitution, got us back to the Declaration. When I return with Dr. Arnn on this Hillsdale Dialogue, all the dialogues available at HughForHillsdale.com, HughForHillsdale.com, everything Hillsdale available at Hillsdale.edu. Go binge listen and then come right back to the Hugh Hewitt Show. Welcome back, America. Happy New Year to all of you, and thanks to Dwayne and Adam and Jake for being here to make this. This is always one of the most popular broadcasts of the year, and people want it all. You can go get it at HughForHillsdale.com. While you're there, get my brand new book, The Fourth Way, a conservative playbook to a lasting Republican majority. But just get smart about the West, and get smart about the guy we're going to talk about now with Dr. Larry Arnn, president of Hillsdale College, the key man.
Now, we've got to make a quick turn, because we have about 6 minutes of talking left in a six-hour presentation. And we've saved our last segment for, in my opinion, the greatest man that the West has yet produced, not saying that there won't be another one. He's only half American, though. He's half English. And I call him the greatest man because, but for him, The West would not have survived World War II, in my opinion, but you worked a long time on Churchill. What is Churchill's greatness, part one?
Well, Churchill is the only statesman in the modern world. I think he's the only one who leaves such a record of what he thought as he did. His deeds are incredibly long. He was in Parliament for... He was in leadership in Parliament for 50 years, roughly. He was in Parliament for 60. He held every high office except Foreign Secretary. He wrote 50 books, roughly. He wrote all his own speeches, with one exception. They are beautiful. His memoranda, his letters, the whole archive weighs 3 tons. There's nobody quite like him to figure out how a practical man thinks and what is the connection in the mind of a practical man between the highest principles and the actions that he takes. It's a very rare thing, and I can tell you from reading in his archive for some years that there's nobody, I mean, it's just awesome what he delivers, what he produces day after day after day. In the greatest crisis that he faced, the time when he saved the world, I believe that there's no other human being who could have been in that place. And I believe that was the one place where the thing could be done. I believe that there's no other human being who could have done it. And it gives you a sense of providence when you think that through. If you know in detail some of the other people who were in the room, on the 28th of May in 1940, when he gave the speech impromptu to about 40 people or 50, that kept Britain in the war and ultimately brought us in, none of them could have done what he did. Very few of them would have been inclined to do it. And he, an old man, he's 65 at this time, he delivers himself of an address that is just changes history.
And we originally taped this on a couple of days in December of 2001. In fact, December 27th, 2001 concluded it. A day, Dr. Arn, when Osama bin Laden's tape is released that says, quoting, "We say the end of the United States is imminent," saying that it is a fragile superpower. Is he right about that? Leo Strauss said the West would never end unless its ideals were eclipsed. What do you think?
Well, what I think is that if you study the record of the West, and especially these statesmen that we've been talking about, and some of the ancient statesmen as well, what you'll see is that living well has always been the challenge. And especially in politics, there are always problems. And sometimes they come to great crises. And what Mr. Bin Laden mistook was he mistook us. He mistook the deepest thing about us. And he should have read a little Churchill, because if he hadn't, he wouldn't be that haggard. If he had done so and understood, he probably wouldn't be that haggard and drawn person hunted from cave to cave that he is right now. And he probably wouldn't have killed those 4,000 people that he killed. Because he would understand that it is true that we are peace-loving people, but because we are in the habit of governing ourselves, we are ready to fight, and we are good at it in the way that no slaves ever can be.
Larry Arn, I want to thank you for spending so much time on this project. I know you were reluctant to do so, but you have done it very, very well indeed.
Thank you, Hugh.
And once again, 1-800-437-2268. I also want to tell people that... we will eventually get these tapes available. I'm already getting requests from day one, and we will make them available to you at some early point in this. Dr. Arn, any personal favorite that they should begin with if people are moved to pick up a book?
Well, you can never go wrong reading Churchill.
Okay. We end where we ended then. Do you happen to know offhand what his quote was about cotton candy or sugar candy?
Of course I do.
Well, please, may I hear it?
"We have not traveled all this way. Across the oceans, across the mountains, across the prairies, because we are made of sugar candy." He was saying that to Hitler.
I love that quote, but it's appropriate as well for our friend, Mr. Bin Laden, and on this, the day of his ultimate challenge to the West. Professor Larry Arn, Dr. Larry Arn, president of Hillsdale College, once again, thank you. And thanks to you, America, for listening. Parts 1 through 5 already done. This concludes part 6 of the special edition of the Hugh Hewitt Show. If you would like information on getting the tapes, of this New Year's Eve and New Year's Day broadcast, you go to www.hughhewitt.com. If you'd like to get on the Hillsdale mailing list where you can receive free, absolutely free of cost, Imprimis, their newsletter of great words and great thoughts, call 1-800-437-2268. And whatever you do, be sure to tune in tomorrow as we return to the regular programming of this, The Hugh Hewitt Show.
Star General Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.